Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. It's estimated that about 16% of people over the age of 40 suffer from overactive bladder. A position statement published in the MJA sets out a clinical approach to the management of adult non-neurogenic overactive bladder. One of its co-authors, Associate Professor Eric Chung, a urological surgeon at the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane, says OAB is underdiagnosed and undertreated. He's my guest on the pod today. Let's start with the very basics then. What is overactive bladder?
Overactive bladder is a condition whereby the patient describes the presence of urinary urgency, frequency, nocturia, with or without urge incontinence.
So does it have any particular cause that we know about?
There are many causes of overactive bladder, and you can kind of describe it in three broad headings. It can be either idiopathic, which is unknown. Mm-hmm. It could be non-neurological, or it could be neurological. So neurological conditions are usually related to conditions like Parkinson, multiple sclerosis, and stroke, whereas the non-neurologic condition can be related to dietary, for example, high caffeine intake, could be related to pharmacotherapy, for example, certain drugs like antihypertensive or diuretics, or it could be related to other medical conditions, for example, diabetes and also chronic diseases.
When a doctor is assessing somebody for frequency or incontinence or whatever, what are the other conditions that need to be excluded before you can land on a diagnosis of OAB?
Well, usually the most common thing we try to exclude are the reversible causes of condition that leads to overactive bladder, like symptoms. For example, the presence of urinary tract infection, mm-hmm. the presence of bladder stone, or bladder malignancy in a patient who are smoker. So these are the common things that you try to exclude before you sort of diagnose the patient with overactive bladder.
Is it curable?
Well, overactive bladder per se is not, technically speaking, curable because we don't really fully understand the pathogenesis behind it.
Right.
But certainly it is a condition that can be treated, and the condition certainly can be prevented from becoming significant and affect the quality of life or result in complication.
What's the first-line treatment?
The first-line treatment for overactive bladder would be, number one, to identify if there's any reversible causes like infection-related, medication-related, mm-hmm. or other medical condition that are sort of like exacerbation, like the diabetes or enlarged prostate.
Yep.
The second thing to do would be to do dietary modification, so patient to avoid certain things that stimulate the bladder, like caffeine,
mm-hmm.
Patient to do time voiding to increase the duration of void between each bathroom visit.
And if that doesn't work to relieve the symptoms, what's next?
If it doesn't relieve the symptoms and we have excluded reversible causes, the next line of treatment would be to commence patient on medical therapy.
Yeah.
And the current climate in Australia, the medical therapy would be a form of anticholinergic drug. And more recently, we also have a new class of drug called the beta-3 agonist drug.
Okay, and what actions do they do?
So the muscarinic, the anticholinergic drug works on the muscarinic receptor. So there's M2 and M3 receptor within the bladder wall that stimulate bladder contraction.
Right.
So anticholinergic inhibit the muscarinic receptor, so that result in relaxation of the bladder. In contrast, the new class of drug, the beta-3 agonist, act on the beta-3 receptor in the bladder. So the beta-3 receptor in the bladder helps to relax the bladder. So by using the beta-3 agonist drug, you actually potentiate the bladder relaxation. So both anticholinergic and beta-3 agonists help the bladder to store more urine by increasing the bladder capacity.
Is there a role for surgery in OAB?
Definitely. As patients sometimes has either become intolerable to the side effect of the drug, for example, anticholinergic, commonly associated with dry mouth, constipation and confusion in elderly,
mm-hmm.
or the patient are not able to tolerate the cost of the medication because a lot of these medications are not on PBS script,
yeah.
or the patient become refractory to the medication, then surgery will be indicated.
Is there, given that this is an important line of treatment, does the government need to put these drugs on the PBS, do you think?
I think the biggest trouble with a lot of time is that the government has done the very bare minimum of drug prescription for a quality of life condition like overactive bladder.
Mm-hmm.
So the government do provide subsidy for ditropine, which is oxybutynin, both in the form of oral and patch. But unfortunately, oxybutynin, while it's a good drug, it has a lot of side effects because it's a non-specific muscarinic receptor. So therefore, the onus is really on the government to try to allocate some spending on condition that potentially may not be as life-threatening as cancer, but certainly has impact on patient quality of life.
What's the role of Botox?
So Botox is a drug that basically works by inhibiting the contraction of the bladder through the acetylcholine receptor.
Right.
So Botox has been approved for use, and certainly Botox is on PBS listed now as of early this year. So the Botox is a drug that is administered through injection in the bladder for the patient, and the durational effect can last somewhere between 6 to 9 months. Well, there's a lot of use of Botox nowadays, not just for cosmetic, but for like chronic pain, spasm condition and things like that.
Given that it's such a debilitating problem in terms of quality of life, how hard is it to manage patient expectations about OAB?
I think the important thing is to acknowledge that this condition certainly has affected the patient quality of life and then reassure the patient that there are things that can be done based on the current evidence in terms of the medical and also minimal invasive surgical option. So I think number one thing to do would be to validate the concern, to identify the degree of impact on the condition on the patient quality of life, and to advise patient appropriate strategy and to escalate the treatment as appropriate.
What's the prevalence in Australia at the moment?
We don't have a nationwide prevalence study on the epidemiology of OAB in Australia, but certainly from literature, and again, the corresponding literature to Western world, we can anticipate somewhere between up to about 20% of women who have some form of overactive bladder throughout their lifetime, and up to about maybe in the vicinity around 12 to 15% in adult men.
Okay.
Because obviously the condition can has a strong correlation with enlarged prostate BPH.
Is there any research being done on the pathogenesis?
There are. At this point in time, certainly there are a lot of theory being propagated in terms of what are the underlying causes. So, for example, it could be related to either the neurological receptor within the bladder. It could be related to the muscle of the bladder, or it could be related to the endothelial covering of the bladder itself.
Okay.
I think at this point in time, it's safe to say that this condition certainly has impacted quite a lot of people, and the algorithm that we used to understand are changing in terms of what we do for the patient. So in the past, we are very limited in what we can do, and surgery, something that is not uncommonly being discussed. But now with the introduction of newer oral medication like the beta 3 agonist, the use of Botox, and even devices like sacral neuromodulation, we work on the nervous pathway in the bladder, the role of open surgery is becoming very, very rare and certainly rarely performed nowadays.
Even though it's impacts on quality of life and that there's no definitive cure, there is plenty of hope for patients to look forward to, isn't there?
That is correct. I think that is one of the take-home message for GP and also for other readers of MJA is that this condition is highly prevalent. This condition is definitely underdiagnosed and undertreated. And there are many strategies nowadays that can be used to offer patients a higher quality of life and certainly allow patients, more importantly, to lead a normal life.
Thank you for your time, Eric. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.